Dealing with soft answers to tough questions. Why soft answers? Because we're to love our enemies and God's enemies. So we're dealing with the tough question of world gods, and this will be the third and the final of the gods we deal with. Success as a surface idol. We'll be looking at 2 Kings 5. Now, making success an idol is not solely the temptation for the upper 2%. You don't have to be a big guy on Wall Street to be tempted to make success an idol. Within your well-defined and limited area of recognition, where you are recognized, at work, your neighborhood, in your home, where I teach at school, within the church, you may desperately seek to be considered the top dog, or choose another animal. When the quest for success becomes an idol, your relationship to it takes on the characteristics of a world religion. For instance, it may provide, you may hope it would provide religious hope. Madonna, pop music legend, she confessed, "I have an iron will, and all of my will has always been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being, and then I get to another stage and I think I'm mediocre and uninteresting. Again and again, my drive in life is from this horrible fear of being mediocre. And that's always pushing me. Because even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove that I'm somebody. My struggle has never ended, and it probably never will." You see, success as a religion, as an idol, saves you from being nobody. Saves you from not counting for anything. It saves you from not meaning anything. I am somebody. So it may provide religious hope, the hope of salvation, hope of redemption. Then, if it's your religion, it may provide religious identity. Some of you will remember Chris Everett. I think she was called Chris Everett Lloyd. I haven't heard that recently. I don't know whether they got divorced, but she was a leading tennis player in the 70s and 80s. Her career win-loss record was the best of any singles player in history. She confessed, "I had no idea who I was or what I could be away from tennis. I was depressed and afraid because so much of my life had been defined by my being a tennis champion. I was completely lost. Winning made me feel like I was somebody. It made me feel pretty. It was like being hooked on a drug. I needed the wins, the applause, in order to have an identity." That's who she was. Success gives you an identity. This is who you are, not just what you do, but who you are. When success ends, you're a nobody once more. And then again, as a religion, it may provide religious passion, the reason to get up in the morning. The late counselor Mary Bell, who helped found the Center for Recovering Families in Austin, Texas, she said this, "Achievement is the alcohol of our time. These days, the best people don't abuse alcohol, they abuse their lives. You're successful, so good things happen." I think I cut some of this out. "You complete a project and you feel dynamite. That feeling doesn't last forever and you slide back to normal. You love the feeling of euphoria, so you've got to have it again. Your self-esteem is on the line because you've been gathering your self-worth externally. An achievement addict is no different from any other kind of addict." Let's recognize then that people who worship success believe that it is their security. Pastor Timothy Keller said, as a pastor, I've often heard people from the upper echelons say, life isn't supposed to be this way when they face tragedy. I've never heard such language in my years as a pastor among the working class or the poor. They kind of expected life to be like this. But they gave their lives to success, and this is the reward I get. People who worship success believe that they are the elite, the chosen ones. A journalist attended a dinner party with a highly successful and wealthy businessman. During that time, he dominated the conversation all evening, but none of the discussion was about economics and finances, his only field of expertise. He held forth on interior design, same-sex colleges, as if his opinion was authoritative. Do you know people like this? They're well known for something or other, and it's like the Hollywood stars who are telling us, the guy from Cheers, I forget what his name is now, predicted that within 4 years all the oceans would be dead. I think that was 20 years ago now, but a comedian was joking about that, saying the president at the time, I forget who it was, said, he was joking, he said, the president said, well, that's a very important point of view, but I'm still going to have to check with, like Madonna first. I want you to remember that what Paul said to the Galatians, that there were two models of life that men may choose. One is the model of Jesus Christ and loving service. Galatians 5:13b and 14. By love, serve one another, for all the law is fulfilled in one word. Even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Loving service. That's one model. Follow Jesus Christ. The other model is the dog-eat-dog competition. The next verse says, but if you bite and devour one another, take heed that you be not consumed one of another. These are the two models. He doesn't give a third one, you see. And which, the idol of success, where does it come down? The idol of success demands a life of competition. It demands a goal of ascendancy over all others. And remember, and it's kind of interesting how often this verse comes up in my thinking anymore. 1 John 2:16, for all that is in the world, he says, love not the world. Then the next verse, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. So we've looked at three idols now. The idol of love, sex, romance caters to the lust of the flesh. And then the idol of money caters to the lust of the eyes, what I want to buy and covet. And so the idol of success caters to the pride of life. I want to take you to the story of Naaman in 2 Kings 5. He was a success. Let me just ask you to think of him as a man at the top of his world. 2 Kings 5:1. Now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with or before his master, and honorable, the Hebrew lifted up or accepted in countenance. So the idea of honorable was he was a face well known and recognized. Because by him the Lord had given deliverance or victory unto Syria over other countries. He was also a mighty man in valor, but he was a leper. So here is success marred with one major flaw. In Israel, the leper had to be kept aside. Israel taught the world what quarantine was all about. And they perhaps didn't follow that. I can't imagine him being in quarantine here with the business that he did. but he was a leper. So he was limited by having the hopeless disease of leprosy. There was no cure then. There is no cure now. Leprosy, technically leprosy, I think the scripture uses the term to describe a number of different diseases, but leprosy itself is actually a disease of the nerves that takes away all sense, all feeling from the body. And all of the infection and running sores and the finger joints falling off, and all this happens because the body gets infected and the leper doesn't know it because he can't feel it. And so it just gets worse. All right, there he is at the top of the lane. The only one higher than him is the king himself. And he has it in tight with the king, even with his limitation. But can you imagine how that one limitation would have, I was going to say eat at him, but you get the idea, it would have bothered him. Well, at some point, he was directed to Jehovah's prophet in Israel. The next two verses, and the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she waited, the King James margin says the Hebrew was, she was before, waited on Naaman's wife. And she said unto her mistress, she said to Naaman's wife, the little maid, would God, my lord, meaning Naaman, were with or before the prophet that is in Samaria, capital of the southern kingdom, for he would recover or gather in him of his leprosy. A little slave girl from Israel knew of the prophet, knew of her God, knew of his power, his ability to cure even leprosy. And by faith, she said, I just wish that my master would go there. Well, the scripture tells us that somebody overheard the conversation and went to Naaman and said, I understand they got a cure in Israel. So successful Naaman had his people contact the prophet's people. Isn't that the way you do it? And the king of Syria said, go and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel. And he departed and took in his hand 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, 10 changes of raiment. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, now when this letter has come to thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman my servant to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy. I didn't include the part where the king of Israel goes crazy. What? He's provoking a war here. What does he think I am, God? Naaman and the king of Israel, or the king of Syria, thought something about Israel. He thought that Jehovah worship was just like his own world religion. You can see it in the story. He thought that Jehovah worship was a servant of the country. He thought that it practiced ritual magic. Remember when he says, I thought he would come over and wave his hand over the spot and say abracadabra. He thought it was influenced by the influential. The bigwigs in the religious. He thought it could be swayed by money. And he thought it would certainly cater to the successful. In the movie Groundhog Day, the egocentric weatherman is caught by a blizzard in a little town of Philadelphia. And so he's on the phone and he says, well, what do you mean all the lines are down? He says, don't you have something for emergencies, like for emergencies or for celebrities? Well, it's both. This is, I'm a celebrity and it's an emergency. You know, provision should be made for us who are the top people. Well, he's put in contact with the prophet. And the knock on the door, who comes to the door but the servant. He was snubbed by the prophet. So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean. And he closed the door. No great welcome, no bowing and scraping. It's such a privilege to stand before a man like Naaman. None of that. But Naaman was wroth and went away and said, behold, I thought, or I said with myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and strike, the Hebrew, move up and down his hand over the place and recover the leper. I thought, I said, are not Abana and Pharpar, rivers of Damascus, back in home Syria, in Syria, better than all the waters of Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. Here was his idea of religion pitted against God's idea. What had happened here? He was ordered to submit to God's command. Just do it. He was given no great thing to show his worth. Verse 13, his servants came near and spake to him and said, my father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldest thou not have done it? How much rather then when he said to thee, wash and be clean? And so he decides to try it. He was made to approach Jehovah God as a common worshiper and not as a privileged aristocrat. This was the true religion fighting down the false religion. Even after he was healed, and he saw that it was truly a miracle, he tried to pay for his healing. This was in his thinking. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him. Now the prophet does see him. And he said, behold, now I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant. I brought all this stuff. Please take it. Let me help with the ministry. You could use the home improvements here. Yeah. But he said, as the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Why do you think he refused? Could he not have used the money? Of course he could have. Could he not have given it away to help others? Of course he could. Why did he refuse this man at this point, this time? Well, let me say it this way. If he had taken it, what would he have taught him? That you can pay for their stuff, see. But what is God's message? It's all of grace. It's too expensive for you to buy. Nothing you can give would pay for what I can give you. Well, let me ask you this. Who do you think is the key character of the story outside of God himself? The key character. Here's my opinion. The suffering servant. The little servant girl. Slave girl. She suffered under Naaman. Again, in verse 2, the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid. Now, she's a servant, serving girl. She's probably in her early teens, but a little girl, little maid. And she waited, she was before, on Naaman's wife. She was a slave. This was not of her choice, you see. So I want you to consider her suffering. She was taken from her home in warfare. Was it just a capture? Was it family got killed? She was parted from all that she knew. She was in a pagan land away from Jehovah worship. She became a slave of the very ones who took her by force. He was the leader of the, if he wasn't there conquering her family, he was the leader. Now, just be her for a moment. How do you feel about Naaman? But that's not how she felt, is it? So what had happened with her, to her? Well, she served under Naaman. Remember the model of Jesus Christ? Loving service. So she remained a person of faith in Jehovah God. We see this, that was her first thought. My God could take care of that. My God's prophet has the power to do that. Belief. So she had forgiven Naaman. Now let me just put this in here. Forgiving always costs the forgiver something. Dave, if I owe you a debt and you forgive it, it costs you the debt. It costs you what I owe you. And so it is with everything. When you forgive, you pay the price for it. Vengeance wants them to pay the price. Forgiveness lets you pay the price. And so here, this little girl began to believe in the sovereignty of God, that God had placed her where she was, and that to be any kind of a testimony of a believer in Jehovah God, she had to be a little different than other people. She desired the best for Naaman. You can hear it in her words. Oh, that my master would just go there. He could be healed. She felt the pain of his leprosy. And she used her limited influence to direct Naaman to God. And God picked it up. Doesn't say the mistress told him. I mean, his wife, her mistress. It says that somebody else overheard the conversation and took it to him. And God worked it over and got to him. And he thought, well, if there's a chance. Let me consider as we close the deeper idols here. Worshiping the glory that others heap on you skews your understanding of the world. It gives the illusion of security and happiness while all the time taking you to the very edge of disaster. The psalmist Asaph fell into this illusion, Psalm 73. For I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no bands in their death, their strength is firm, they are not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued like other men. No fair. I was good. I'm not rich. What's going on here? God dispelled the illusion. He says, when I thought to know this, it was too painful for me until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then understood I their end, where they end up. And he says, oh my goodness, they have all this wealth now. They have all this ability now. And it's leading them right to hell. Surely thou didst set them in slippery places. He begins the psalm by saying, my feet almost slipped. Now he says, wow, you put them in slippery places. Thou cast them down unto destruction. how are they brought into desolation? As in a moment. They are utterly consumed with terrors. He sees the end of their life when all of their money and all of their security and all of their hope fails with this life and they drop off into eternity. All the illusion of their security and happiness ends right there. What do we need to do? We don't spurn success. The Apostle Paul said, if you can better yourself, do it. If you can be a more useful Christian by being free, if you are a slave, you can be free, well, take that. But turn to the true provider of joy and the only hope of eternal security. Jesus himself prayed, "And now come I to thee, and these things I speak in the world," why? "That they might have my joy fulfilled in themselves." He's looking for us to have true joy. Not the temporary happy, happy, happiness. The true joy, the everlasting joy. Jesus counseled about what you trust. "No man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon," riches. "Therefore I say unto you," serving mammon means that you're taking thought for everything, see? You're providing for yourself, you think. But he says, "Take no thought for your life, what you shall eat, what you shall drink, nor yet for your body, what you shall put on. Is not the life more than meat," meaning food, "and the body than raiment?" We recognize then that in fact, God handles our joy and our security. And he's the only one who truly can. So when we try with the boastful pride of life, not just to be the best we can be, but to be better than others, then we're worshiping the idol of success. And it's a false idol.